And good morning. Another lovely morning in Park City. And this is Larry Warren, and welcome to Community Voices. Linda Gorton is normally here, but she's enjoying a few of these last great days of fall. And she is off, and Pam Wiley is joining us this morning. And Pam, we're both looking forward to a repeat interview with Charles Mann. Author Charles Mann was on with us many months ago when his book 1491, kind of a groundbreaking work, appeared in paperback. Well, now he has his sequel, 1493, out in hardback right now. And this is Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. And Charles is just a great one for making connections of how things changed worldwide based on one event in 1492 that we all learned about. And Charles Mann, welcome to the program this morning.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, following up on the bark beetles, you know, that's kind of a similar situation. It's some little change in elsewhere in the world. Global warming is now creating just catastrophic effects on our forests, and we'll get to that in the second half hour. But first, welcome back to Community Voices, Charles, and we want to talk about your new book, 1493. But by way of introduction, let me first say that you're a well-known magazine writer for some of the top magazines in the country, Atlantic, Science, Wired, Fortune, New York Times, Smithsonian, and I even see on your resume that you've written series for Law and Order. So, a man of diverse words you are. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
This book, 1493, is the follow-up to 1491, which was the story of what the Americas were like before European influences, the arrival of Columbus. And just give us a quick synopsis, a couple of paragraphs on what 1491 was all about as kind of a prequel to what we're going to talk about this morning, 1493.
Well, when I went to school, in the few pages they devoted to the first, 15 or 30,000 years of American history, what we were taught is that Native people walked across the Bering Strait 12,000 years ago, which isn't all that long ago as far as these things go. They lived for the most part in small, scattered bands, and they had so little impact on the environment that when Columbus landed, the Americas were, for all intents and purposes, a wilderness. And I guess one way to summarize the book is to say that the last 20 or 30 years of research by anthropologists, archaeologists, geographers, ecologists, botanists, a whole diverse range of researchers has been to come to the conclusion that all three of these things are wrong, that Indians were here for far longer than previously believed, they're here in much greater numbers than previously believed, and they had much more impact on the environment than previously believed. And that's sort of in a nutshell what the book's about.
And actually they had vibrant, well-organized communities, didn't they?
Yeah, throughout much of the Americas. In fact, it was kind of like Europe at the time. In Europe, most people either lived in cities or were in villages that provided, commodities like food for cities. And the same was true in the Americas. And the images that we have of the sort of nomadic bands, well, they did exist, but they also existed in Europe. It's like the folks in Lapland or something were nomads. And so it's better to think of them as an urban societies than, the kind of images that we have in textbooks.
So then in 1493, the new book, you jump forward, and it's really, everybody thinks Tom Friedman, when he wrote The World is Flat, wrote the first definitive piece on globalization. But I think globalization, according to your thesis, began in 1493.
Right. My wife says that my book title should be something like, Ha-ha, Tom Friedman, the world has been flat for 400 years.
That's a good title.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe.
It's a long tagline.
It's a long tagline.
It is a long tagline. Yeah.
It's a little bit snarky. I wouldn't want to do this. But the idea is actually quite simple. As you probably learned in school, 200-plus million years ago, the world consisted of a single giant continent that scientists call Pangaea, and geological forces broke it up and forever separated the continents. And over these millions and millions of years that the Eastern Hemisphere and Western Western Hemisphere were separate, they developed completely different suites of plants and animals. And if you're a scientist, the reason that Columbus is important is that, in effect, he recreates Pangaea. He brings the continents back together. And then these long-separated ecosystems suddenly collide and mix. And the result is an ecological convulsion. That's the biggest event in the history of life since the death of the dinosaurs, and it has huge impact in human history as well.
And this must have happened slowly, because starting in 1493, ships going back and forth across the Atlantic were few in number and small in size. But even that early, what happened? Germs started going back and forth, and
right,
seeds started going back and forth?
Yeah, well, if you think about it, Columbus brought with him on his second voyage in 1493, that was his first attempt to create a permanent European bastion in the New World, in the Americas, and he brought with him all sorts of European creatures, horses and cattle, all sorts of European crops, like, of course, wheat, and other European species, and that's the sort of the beginning of the invasion. But just as you say, the most important passengers were invisible and unknown to him. And during the first 150 years of colonization, which is a blink of an eye in geological terms, a huge wave of diseases came from Europe to the Americas. And the result was that somewhere between two-thirds and 90% of the people in the Americas died. It was the greatest demographic catastrophe in the history of the human race. And that was just the beginning of this exchange of organisms, across the oceans.
Are you saying,
by the way, has been called the Columbian Exchange by a wonderful historian named Alfred Crosby.
90% death rate, was that across the Americas or on isolated islands where he landed?
Well, there's a lively argument about exactly how many people died in which places. But I think it's pretty safe to say that across the entire Americas, from Tierra del Fuego up to the Arctic Circle, there was somewhere between two-thirds and a 90% death rate.
So basically, the first Europeans came over and gave a friendly yet deadly handshake to the indigenous population.
Right.
Well, did it go both ways? Were the Americas healthy, or did they send something nasty back to Europe?
We sent tobacco.
It really went mostly one way. And the reason for this is kind of a evolutionary quirk. There are very few domesticable animals that could be domesticated in the Americas at the time of Columbus. So there were no cattle, there were no horses, there were no camels, there were no goats, there were no sheep, there were no chickens. None of the creatures that we think of as being in farms, and no equivalent creatures, were in the Americas. And most of the big killers are what scientists call zoonotic diseases. And that's where, if you live close to animals, as Europeans and Asians did, every now and then an animal disease can become a human disease. It can mutate. It can, as they say, jump the species barrier. We saw this with bird flu, right? Remember,
right,
bird flu,
sure,
people were worried about, and that started as a bird
swine flu before that.
And yeah, swine flu before that. And so all the big killers, like smallpox, which probably came from a horse disease or a camel disease, measles, which is descended from bovine rinderpest, flu, which, as we mentioned, comes from either ducks or chickens, all of these diseases, the big killers in human history, were zoonotic diseases. And because the Americas had so few domesticable animals, they didn't have any of this kind of disease. And so there's a huge epidemiological imbalance. And I would argue that this is one of the central facts in American history. If you only learn one thing from my book, it should be this, that there is this huge demographic catastrophe. And that explains, to my way of thinking, how it was that Europeans in small groups at the end of very long supply lines could go over and establish camps here in the Americas without being pushed out by the numerically much more superior natives.
And eventually conquer just massive civilizations like the Inca in Aztecs in South America.
And were
right.
they pretty well exhausted by that time when they were conquered?
Well, it's hard for us to imagine, but put yourself back in those days where you don't have a germ theory of disease. You don't really know what disease is. I mean, neither the Europeans nor the Indians knew what disease was. They thought it was a manifestation of the will of God or the will of, heaven. And, all of a sudden, two out of every three people dies. It's a completely shattering event. And, you know, at that point, it's pretty easy for foreigners to march in and take over stuff. This historian I mentioned, Alfred Crosby, has pointed out that the Black Death kind of did the same thing to Europe, killed a third of the people. And if Genghis Khan had happened to come in right after the Black Death, well, you and I would not be speaking, you know, Indo-European language.
Exactly. Exactly. So whether you give it a supernatural source or not, it's you're basically down and out and easy to be conquered.
Okay, so Europeans gave the Americas diseases and catastrophe. What did Europeans get in return?
They got a bunch of things. And again, this is really the beginning of globalization. On the biological front, they got things like the potato and maize or corn. That's what maize is. Corn is called maize outside the U.S. And what those did were they're much productive than wheat, particularly the potato, which is, roughly speaking, you get four times as much, what scientists say, dry matter out of the potato per acre than you do for wheat. And it suddenly allowed Europe, which had never been able to feed itself, And many historians believe that this really marked the beginning of European empires, because suddenly they had a big population boom, and they were able to send people out to foreign places. And because they weren't racked by famine and food riots and all the other things that have been a characteristic of European history for centuries, they were much more politically stable and able to begin these large-scale empires.
So this is Spanish explorers down in the Andes who discovered that the peoples there cultivated potatoes and brought this strange root back.
Right, and then for a 2,000-mile band between Ireland and the Ukraine, you know, by the 18th century, the main people's diet is potatoes. And in fact, in Ireland, as it's famous, 40% of the, or an estimated 40% of the population ate no solid food other than potatoes.
So basically, what you're saying is that not only do armies march on their stomachs, but civilizations do. When they're well fed, then they can grow and prosper and be stable.
And the second thing that the Americas gave in a major way to Europe was in 1545, another event that I think that children should learn about in school. The Spaniards discovered a huge mountain of silver in Bolivia called Potosi. And up 13,000 feet in the Andes, they created what was then the largest city in all of our hemisphere to mine this enormous amount of silver. And Europe, which had been relatively poor up until that point, suddenly became wealthy. It's kind of like the Beverly Hillbillies. And this wealth of silver just poured out of the mountain and doubled or tripled the world supply of this precious metal, which is the basic currency of you know, everywhere in the world. And suddenly much wealthier Europe could go out and buy things. And this tide of silver washing around the planet is the real beginning of globalization.
And in fact,
that they're carrying the silver, and the things that the silver buys come all these other organisms that have such a large impact, like the potato in Europe or the sweet potato in China.
And in fact, you know, we're going through a recession, and we had a depression a couple of generations ago. And in fact, the discovery of silver and the sudden wealth you write leads to a glut, and that leads to a global economic recession of an earlier time.
Right, the first worldwide financial calamity, which is really because the banks simply couldn't deal with this vast amount of silver. Neither banks or governments could really deal with this vast amount of silver, and the fact that suddenly everybody was interconnected. And the result was a global financial calamity, the very first one, and one that sort of weirdly like some of the stuff that we're going through today.
Interesting. Very interesting, yes. It's we all are floating up together, or we're all sinking down together, huh?
Right. We're all tied together. And it's nice when we're riding up and not so nice when we're riding down.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now has it always been the case that the European civilizations conquered the American civilizations? Were the native populations of the Americas able to prevail in anything, or just dominated and exploited completely by the Europeans?
Well, the conquests were much more partial than to think. The Maya, for instance, were never really conquered. And in fact, there's been a lot of unrest in southern Mexico. You remember a few years back, you would hear about Comandante Zero and or some, I think, right. and so forth. And you would also, years before that, in Guatemala, there was a tremendous amount of unrest and the government trying to massacre people and so forth. And at bottom, what that was were Maya-speaking people resisting Spanish-speaking governments. So the Maya, or I don't even know how many millions there are, 10 million, 20 million, I just don't really know, have never really been conquered and are still pushing back. Then you had places like in the Southwest, not all that far from you guys, you had the Comanche Empire. And there's a, you know, when the horses came, the Comanche moved in from the north and for about 150 years created this state that the Comanche Empire, Comancheria, it's sometimes called, that basically kicked out all the Europeans. And so these stories of resistance, which occurred all over the continent, are a little bit glossed over in the sort of overall story about European triumphs, which of course is true. Europeans did triumph, but it was a much, much more dicey enterprise.
Maybe we just haven't heard about that many Mayan and Comanche publishing houses.
Well, but there is actually right now, I think, on the bestseller list, is a on the paperback bestseller list, a book by a fellow named Gwynn, G-W-Y-N-N-E, that is about the Comanche Empire, and it's really quite a good story. And people who are interested should read it. I mean, of course, I want them to read my book, but that's also another one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, to continue globalization, it wasn't just Europe and the Americas, because Europe had also established some trade routes overland to Asia.
Right.
So Asia plays into this when Columbus discovers the Americas. How does that bring change to Asia?
What Columbus was trying to do was to establish continuous trade across the ocean with China. I mean, that was what his goal was. And in fact, you know, one remembers that Columbus insisted to the end of his life that he actually had landed in Asia. He was sure that, you know, that the islands of the Caribbean were sort of islands that are just outside of Japan somehow. And the fact is, of course, that he hadn't, that there was this, you know, unknown continent in the middle. But when the Spaniards discovered this huge amount of silver, a very large fraction of it, and historians argue over how much, you know, half or two-thirds or, you know, what the figure is, ended up in China, both indirectly because Europeans would buy something that was in China, and directly by being shipped across the Pacific Ocean. And there was this thing called the galleon trade, which is completely fascinating, where these huge ships full of silver would go to Manila in the Philippines, which was a Spanish outpost, and there would meet junks from China, ships from China, that were filled with goods, and there would be this massive exchange, and then each side would head back. The Chinese ships filled with silver, and the Spanish ships filled with silk and porcelain and slaves.
Okay. And weren't there some crazy things happening there, like in Manila, when some Chinese came looking for the three mountains of gold and silver?
Right.
And there expected is. Everybody to bow down to them, and if they didn't, they were flogged?
Yeah, it was kind of a crazy enterprise. So Manila was started in 1571, and this is when, if you like, the pulse of global commerce, you know, became continuous. And, you know, there are academic papers with titles like Globalization Began in 1571. You know, that's sort of the birth date of it 440 years ago. And what happened was you had a small number of Spaniards there in Manila in conditions they didn't regard very well because it was, you know, hot and they often got sick. And then an enormous number of Chinese, you know, maybe 1,000 Spaniards and 30,000 Chinese and 3,000 or 4,000 Japanese, all surrounded by Filipino natives. And so you had this, you know, weird sort of cosmopolitan commercial entrepot there in Manila. And periodically the Spaniards would panic and go out and massacre thousands of Chinese. And one of these incidents was in 1603 when, in a kind of a lunatic enterprise, some crazy people from the Chinese court came to Manila and wanted to find out if there were giant mountains of gold and silver there. And it was, is this the actual source of the silver that kept coming into China from Spain? And they were mandarins, and they expected all the Chinese there to bow down to them. And it just completely freaked the Spaniards out. They're sure that this is a reconnaissance mission for conquest. And ultimately it led to one of these massacres in which 20,000 or so Chinese people were killed.
So the forerunners of the Three Stooges, which is kind of what they were, just led to this massacre. What I thought was amazing was that within, 6 months or something afterwards, everything was back to normal, and they wanted the immigrants to come back in because both China and Spain liked the trade.
Right. You know, okay, so you killed a whole bunch of people, but, you know, money is money.
Yeah.
And the Chinese needed the silver because that was what they used for currency. I mean, the Spanish ships that were coming in were, from the Chinese point of view, shiploads of money, right? And the Europeans in New Spain, which is to say, you know, Spain's Latin American empire, and also in Spain, were really, really wanted Chinese silk and porcelain. I mean, this was the sign that you had made it if you could wear silk clothes and eat off porcelain. This was, you know, you wouldn't be a well-off Spaniard if you couldn't have these things.
You know, it's interesting that all around the world there are these pockets of things like a mountain of silver in Bolivia and silk worms in China and potatoes in Peru, and then soon they're moving all over the world. And also in the Americas were rubber trees, or the latex, and when the Industrial Revolution comes along, this becomes one of the most vital commodities on Earth.
Right. To have a Industrial Revolution, there's a historian at UCLA named Susanna Hecht who put it to me this way. She said, look, if you want to have an Industrial Revolution, you need three substances. You need fossil fuels, which is mainly coal and oil, and those are distributed all over the planet. There's really no shortage of them anywhere. You need to have iron to make steel, and iron deposits are, again, all over the planet. Most people who want to have an Industrial Revolution have access to it. And the third thing you need is rubber. And rubber is really important because you need it for belts, you need it for gaskets, you need it for O-rings, you need it for all these parts that make to translate the motion of machines to whatever it is that you want. And also, whenever you join metal pipes together, because they're vibrating, and steam engines and so forth, you need gaskets to cushion them. Otherwise, there are going to be these tremendous explosions.
And there's only one substance on Earth that will...
That, at that time, would do it.
...will deliver that need.
Right. And the rubber, the best quality rubber, and the only really, you know, one that people would really be able to use in industrial settings was in Brazil. And there's this tree, Hevea brasiliensis, that has latex it's not sap, but it's kind of like sap. And people could tap the rubber tree much the way I live in New England, and people tap sugar maples. And the sap, you know, goes into buckets, and then people boil it down to produce maple syrup. And in a similar way, people would tap latex and boil it down to produce rubber, which then they would ship out of the Amazon. And the result was, in the late 19th century, a rubber boom. And crazy adventurers from all over the world descended upon the Amazon, and then there was a scramble for the Amazon, as Hecht calls it, in which various European nations all vied to get a piece of the action by using their colonies to say, oh, well, actually, we own a big chunk of the Amazon. And so there's a lot of, you know, jostling around, and the rather amazing thing is that Brazil beat them all back. Meanwhile, and this is where the Columbian Exchange comes in, this British adventurer named Henry Wickham goes up the Amazon and smuggles out 70,000 seeds, rubber tree seeds, takes them to Kew Garden in London, where they sprout, only a few of them sprout, and then they take those to Southeast Asia. And long story short, the result is now an area in Southeast Asia, roughly the size of Great Britain, is covered with rubber trees. And so this Brazilian tree is now sort of the plant that ate Southeast Asia. And in fact, the size of these rubber plantations are growing because it turns out that natural rubber is better for many purposes than synthetic rubber. You can make synthetic rubber that's as good, but it's much too expensive. And as people use more rubber for high-tech purposes, they plant more and more trees. And so, you know, this part of the Columbian
So we only have a few minutes left. Can you, this is a, just a fascinating book. There's so many wonderful little stories in it, just like that one, where instead of just being confined to Brazil, they go, well, let's expand the pie. We'll just
let's globalize.
Yeah, globalize. And go to Southeast Asia. What are your takeaway lessons from the book?
Well, one is, as we talked about, globalization has been around for hundreds of years, and so to imagine that we can shut the door, it's a little bit late. But the second is that there's a kind of a political fight over globalization, as you know, and the history of this fight has been. The one side says that trade is nothing but good and there's no problems with it, and the other side says that trade is nothing but bad and we should shut the door. And the real lesson is, I think, that there has been huge gains from world trade. I mean, the sweet potato in China and the potato in Europe kept tens of millions, maybe even hundreds of millions of people alive. I mean, this is a great thing. But there was also huge losses. And it almost threatened to cancel these. And so my own feeling is that we would be a lot better in all these disputes about globalization if both sides would cop to the fact that the other side has a point.
And it's interesting that some of the parallels you draw or conclusions you reach about the Columbian Exchange still occur today. SARS breaks out in Asia, and within the length of time it takes an airplane to fly to the U.S., we're worrying about it here and in Europe and everywhere else.
The speed of
these impacts has just rocketed forward.
Right, and where we are, there's a beetle that's eating our forest just like yours, and is a enormous concern, and it's an import from China, and we also had earlier the Dutch elm disease. Which is also an Asian immigrant, and
so we can't blame the Dutch
blight.
For that.
Well, no, and also chestnut blight, which is actually a European import, as I understand it, and these have dramatically reshaped all the forests on the East Coast. At the time of Columbus, something like one out of every four trees in the eastern forest was a chestnut, and now there's essentially no chestnuts.
Well, that's a great segue to our next segment, which is about the pine bark beetle and what it's doing to the western forest. So, Charles Mann, thanks very much for joining us. Your new book is 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Bye-bye.
Thanks.